As many of you know, I've been working on a book, although not during the month of September because of Christmas. And the book is Miracles and Answered Prayers. And it's a book project that Swami Kriyananda started and then decided it wasn't for him to do, so he handed it off to me. So I've had the pleasure of collecting. I need to, since you've broken it anyway, I was telling you about my book and I won't forget. When I was younger, I used to mumble a lot. I was very hard to understand. I think I had a conflict about wanting to express my ideas and not wanting to express my ideas. And I became the, Swami's gotten older, I've become the tester for his hearing aids. If he can hear me, he knows the hearing aid is a good one. But when I used to mumble a lot, he said to me once, in his way of trying to correct you without hurting your feelings, he said, if some people mumbled, I would be grateful not to have to listen to what they have to say. He said, but what you say for the most part is interesting, so if you would please just speak up, I'd appreciate it. So, I've learned to speak up. Now, in the course of working on this book, I've had the opportunity to just collect some really wonderful stories from many people, mostly at Ananda and from other sources. They're coming in also. If you have any stories, let me know. I had to put the book aside for December because of Christmas. But this morning I was remembering one really wonderful story that I'm going to share with you now because it's also very relevant to what we're talking about. I received this from a man at Ananda. And he told me that when he was in his 20s, he moved out to California from the Midwest. And he'd hardly ever seen an ocean and really knew nothing about them. And he found himself, I believe in Southern California somewhere, on a beautiful day with the ocean in front of him. And he says he vaguely remembers a sign that said, no lifeguard, dangerous tides. But it just didn't mean anything to him. So he just plunged into the ocean and he was just swimming and having this fabulous new experience. When all of a sudden he found out what dangerous tides meant, there was a rip tide at that particular beach, and it just grabbed him. And he found himself just being carried farther and farther out to sea, and he struggled as hard as he could against it. Literally, he said, you don't really think that you can just keep trying until you can't try anymore, but he did. He just fought and fought and fought absolutely. He couldn't make any headway against it. It took him all the way out. And then finally, he said he was so exhausted, as he put it, he really went belly up. He just turned onto his back and just lay there like this. And he was being, he said, tossed about like a rag doll in the waves. He turned on his back and he said he had just begun to meditate, but he didn't really have what he would have called a deep relationship with God. So he said his response, in retrospect, rather surprised him. But he lay on his back, and he looked at the sky, and he could sort of see the ocean all around him. And he just said, in his heart, he said, God, I'm just going to give myself back to you. And it was completely conscious that he had been loaned somehow, and now it was over, and he just had to return himself like a library book, you know, just coming back. And he said he didn't pray to live, and he didn't pray to die quickly, as sometimes people do. He just gave himself back. And he said he discovered that self-offering is bliss. Because in the very moment that he did that, completely unexpectedly, he was just overwhelmed with a feeling of perfect happiness and perfect freedom. Just like it was not his problem anymore, he'd been returned. And then as he said, as he lay there, just on his back in this feeling, he gradually became aware of the fact that he was in completely calm water. And then a channel of calm water had opened up, and he rested there until he had enough strength, and then he just paddled back to shore. Now he also wrote to me, which was so sweet, he said the one thing that stayed from him above all from that experience is that self-offering is bliss. And he says now when he does his kriyas, he often remembers that the more I offer myself, the more bliss I will have. Well, yesterday, when we were having our all-day meditation, I was doing my kriyas, and I can't explain it in depth here, but because it's an initiation rather than a public teaching. But the essence of kriya has to do with the breath, and it has to do with drawing the breath through the chakras, bringing the breath to the spiritual eye. And I was doing my kriyas, and I was remembering this man giving himself back to God, returning himself to God. And I tried to think, what is it that we're offering when we're doing our kriyas? I was trying to put all these pieces together. And of course, in the all-day meditation, we were having some discussion about it on Friday night before, those of us who were planning to attend. And somebody in the discussion had never, this is his first year doing it. And, you know, there's a little bit of a thought of, this is a big project, exactly how does it work? And we were remarking that one of the things that makes it less difficult is because there's nothing else you can do. You're not sitting in your own home where you could get up and have breakfast. You know, you're not having other commitments that in 2 hours I have to get up and I have to go do this. It's like this day is just for meditation, and partly that complete mental freedom makes it so much easier than it does when other alternatives can intrude. But still, I was sitting there in this meditation, and all that we are, because the eyes are closed, the body is still, there's silence in the room, even wearing earplugs, so even little sounds of the consciousness of other people being around is mitigated. So who am I? What is being offered back? And then the kriya concentration is based on the breath, but what you're actually drawing is the life force. You're drawing it through the chakras, and you're offering it at the spiritual eye. And the awareness that we're coming back down to the essence of what we really are, which is this life force, which manifests in us, for the most part, as breath. But here's the step beyond that. The yogis all talk about the breathless state, where your life force is still there, and your awareness is still there, but breath, you see, is an outer manifestation of just the life current itself flowing up and down the spine. And even when we're doing the kriya, the breath is simply the way we access the current. It's not really about the breath. It's just that's the doorway into the breath. When we teach Meditation 1, our first meditation course, the meditation technique you learn is watching the breath. It's very common. Many paths teach it. The reason we do that is because the breath is that link between what we are aware of and what we are not aware of. When I teach it, I explain to people, you see, breath is just between a voluntary and an involuntary action. You can make your breath do things by the conscious use of your will, but you can't ultimately control it with your will. If you try to hold your breath, for example, to commit suicide, it doesn't work, because at the point at which your body is too much deprived of oxygen, your brain will go unconscious, and then the other part of you will take over and you'll begin to breathe. So it's right in between. What it's really like, the breath is like the myth of Theseus and Ariadne, I believe. And he had to go into the labyrinth to slay the Minotaur, and then he had to come back out again. And she held a spool of thread, and he took the thread. And so he was able to go in, he was able to conquer the demon, and then he was able to get out again because he had that thread to follow. And so when we come into manifestation in this physical world and go out on this great, enormously distracting adventure of being involved in this physical world, where all of these realities begin to capture our imagination from the very, very beginning. From the moment the baby comes out of the womb, it starts looking around to see what's happening. I've shared with you when I was with friends when their baby girl was born. Minutes after the baby was born, the father's holding his hand. The little girl grasps her tiny, tiny minutes old fingers, and she's holding on to his great big hand like that. Immediately, we reach outward. That's what we do. That's the way our energy is focused. And then we go on. Incarnations. This is what the Gita talks about today. Those who find my secret no longer wander like this, but we wander for incarnations through, literally, through this labyrinth with this inner awareness that somewhere there's a pearl of great price. There's a fulfillment of longings that we can't even articulate, but that move us, a prayer of yearning, a wordless prayer of yearning goes up from earth. That's what we say in our Festival of Light. And all of us have that wordless prayer of yearning for something that we know is there. And we go through this labyrinth. And God, the whole time, is holding the spool. And the thread that we have unraveled is the life force through breath. And so at some point, it occurs to us that maybe what we're looking for is not outside of us. That in fact, the one consistency, not only in this incarnation, but the one consistency in all of our incarnations is our own inner consciousness. And the thought begins to occur to us very simply, not what's going on around me and what can I do, but what is this I that's even asking the question? What is this constant reality I'm carrying around? And we begin to look inward one way or another and begin to ask that question. And then when we really begin to seek is when we begin to discover teachings and methods and so on, and we start to find the breath. One Kriya Yogi Swami, who is not from our particular lineage, but he traces his lineage to Sri Yukteswar. And he was at Ananda Village, and he was going to give a satsang. And it was sort of interesting to me. He was a very fine man, Swami Shankarananda from Rishikesh. And he gave a satsang. It's very hard to teach at Ananda in the sense of teachers coming in from other lineages. Because, and I'll just say this, Swami Satchidananda, who's now passed away, of the Integral Yoga Institute, he came to visit Ananda Village one year. Swami Kriyananda was out of the country at the time, and we hosted him, and he gave a satsang. He was a very fine teacher and a very gracious man. And at the end of having spent a day through our community, he sat in the satsang, and he said it so sweetly. He said, I don't know what to talk about tonight because I cannot think of one thing that Swami Kriyananda has not already taught you. A beautiful compliment, the way he turned it. So when then this Swami Shankarananda was speaking, I was wondering what he was going to do. And what he talked about was breath. It was a most interesting discussion because what he talked about was if there is one consistency in our lives, it's breath. It's the only thing that's always there. You know, if we're imprisoned, if we're ill, if we're healthy, if we're happy, if we're sad. And so he gave us just this whole discussion about how when everything else goes away from us, we simply come back to the breath. Now, of course, that's meditation and that was Kriya. So there I was yesterday just sitting there thinking, what am I even offering? And you see, once you start just offering that thread of energy moving up and down the spine, your body goes away, your ego goes away, your duties go away, your relationships go away, everything goes away. And there was this sudden understanding or a moment of perception. I won't advance it to a revelation, but it was a moment of perception. Oh my goodness, how different reality is from what we think. And how different the consciousness of a master is. And here we are in today's reading. Swami Kriyananda is there with Paramahansa Yogananda. Who's this dynamic, wonderful, interesting man who has totally captivated him? Swami Ji talks about how he found Yogananda from the book Autobiography of a Yogi, from his picture on the cover. In the course of these different stories that I've been collecting, quite a few people have mentioned to me, when this happened, I owned a copy of Autobiography of a Yogi. I had never read it, but sometimes I would take the book off the shelf and just look into the eyes of the man whose picture was on the cover. And, you know, just like, how often do we do that with anything that we have? But so many people said, I would just take the cover off and look into those eyes. And Swami Kriyananda was a very powerful, intellectual, forceful individual of 22. He found that book in a bookstore, and the way he tells the story is so interesting. First, he didn't buy the book, and then a few days later, he was impelled to go and buy it. But the part of the story that's interesting, he took it off the shelf, and he was going to buy it, and he met a friend in the bookstore in New York City. And this friend was a very outgoing, kind of worldly, ambitious sort of fellow. And they were both just graduating college age. And his friend starts talking to him about how things were really going well for him. He had a job on Madison Avenue, and he was going into advertising, and it really looked like it was going to work out for him, and the opportunities were just fabulous, like this. And Swamiji says he's holding Autobiography of a Yogi with this almost, because the picture of life that this man was so ambitiously seeking, from Swami Kriyananda's point of view, was going to be a living hell. Because none of that, because of his own many, many, many incarnations. And it's not that these things are bad, they're necessary lessons. You can't say kindergarten is bad because it's not a PhD program, you know, and you can't say that a PhD program is bad because it's not God realization, because these things are stages on the journey. But for Swami Kriyananda to work for himself, to become wealthy, to have power in the world, to have a nice home and a family, where many people would be striving for that fulfillment, for Swamiji, it was not the pearl of great price that he was seeking. And here this man was just epitomizing it. And Swamiji said, the book that he was holding to his heart, the presence of Master on that book, he said, somehow or another, this yogi and I had become allies, and he was my friend, and he was going to be my alternative to this whole reality that was being presented to him. Isn't that just extraordinary? How in just minutes, you know, nothing, he hadn't even opened or read the book, but the vibration of consciousness was there communicating to him that there is a completely other reality. So sitting and meditating, what am I offering? I'm offering something that is so different than the I that I usually think of myself as, that we all think of ourselves as. And as I was reflecting on that, I thought, ah, no wonder the masters are always misunderstood. Because they come to bring us something that is, as Master said to Swami Kriyananda, if you only knew my consciousness. If you could only actually understand, which Master also said when he was talking, Swamiji, one remark, because Swami wore a beard, he looked a little bit like the traditional image of Christ, and Swamiji said once to Master, well, I'd rather be Christ than merely look like him. Master so casually said, oh, that will come. Just like that. That will come. In fact, that's how Master saw us already, because it's not as if it isn't with us now. We're breathing, all of us. The breath, the energy, the thread of the divine is as much present now as it ever will be. That's why we call it self-realization. We don't acquire it, we simply realize it. We simply, one day, wake up, literally, and realize, oh, all of this has just been a way of expressing, but the truth is this thread of the divine that flows through us. So when a little baby Jesus is born, and even though he's in a little baby form, that consciousness is fully present. And in the time that the Bible was written, deep in Kali Yuga and so on, he had a very difficult assignment, did Jesus, because there was no understanding of energy and magnetism and vibrations. And when Swami first met Master and Master asked him how he liked Autobiography of a Yogi, Swamiji said, well, it brought me here from New York. I loved it, sir. It was alive with consciousness. And Master said, that's because it has my vibrations. That's what Master said to him. It has my vibrations in it. And Swamiji said, even in the moment, he thought of something you would stand on that would shake you like this. Because even the idea of vibrations, even in 1948, was just such an odd idea because people weren't thinking in terms of flows of energy. Now, whether we understand it exactly or not, we understand that magnetism goes forward and we receive it. We can understand holding that book and feeling the living power of it. So when Jesus is born, Jesus is a fully self-realized master, which is to say, he animates this body, but he doesn't live in it in any way that the rest of us live in our bodies. We're conscious of our bodies. We're limited by our bodies. We're not even, as Swamiji says, omnipresent in our whole bodies. Our consciousness is very much centered really here in the medulla, where the ego is centered, and from this point we look out through the eyes. Isn't that so? One of our friends, Bharat, when he does his nature games, sometimes he blindfolds people and has them walk through the forest with a friend helping you with a blindfold on, and you discover that you don't even know where your feet are most of the time. Now imagine, I was with Swami Kriyananda once in Disneyland, of all places, which we used to like to go to every once in a while. Now it's become a little rajasic. It's not as sweet as it used to be. We were lining up for the electric parade, and we wanted to get there early so we'd have good seats. There were about 20 of us together. We'd been in Los Angeles doing a big something or another, and we were celebrating at Disneyland. So we came early to have our little spot. And Swamiji just went into a bhav. He went into a spiritual mood. And we were looking out over, you know, you can see hundreds, even thousands of people just by looking around at Disneyland, all kinds of people. And Swamiji just turned like this and he said, imagine not merely loving all these people, which was enough of a stretch. He said, imagine being all these people. And he said, that's the consciousness of a master. That he understands that the life force which flows in him flows equally in all. And then, right there at Disneyland, we were just so moved by that, we all just sat down on the sidewalk and started meditating. We had, right in the middle, about 20, well, there were enough of us, so we defined a whole space. We just sat down and we meditated about half an hour. And when we looked up, you know, the electric parade was going by and all these people were there, and we sort of got back up and got back into Disneyland. But that is the consciousness of a master. So Jesus is born into this little body, and last week I talked about the baby and what it brings out of us, or somewhere I talked about that. Maybe it was in the webinar I gave. Just the baby and all that the loving of the baby brings out of us. But don't mistake even for a moment what's there. And that's where the three wise men come. We call them wise. They become gradually kings. Isn't that interesting? Kings, because they must have been powerful and rich. And maybe they were kings. But what they really were was wise. They were wise men. And they followed his star. His star is that star. And that star is what you perceive at the spiritual eye when you offer all of your energy into that. When they were building the temple in Assisi, Italy, the Temple of Light, Arjuna was in charge of various aspects of the building. And they wanted to make a representation in glass of the spiritual eye. And they were having trouble figuring out how to get this made in the artistic way they wanted it. And he's very intuitive. And he was wandering around the city of Rome thinking about this, praying to Master. And he sort of followed his intuition. And he went into a shop that makes blown glass that he just found. And he starts talking to the artisan there. And he says, we're building a temple and we want a piece for the altar. We'd like it to be this deep indigo blue, and then with a gold field around it, and then a white star in the center. And the more he talks, the man's eyes get bigger and bigger. He says, "When I close my eyes, I often see that. What is it?" He knew nothing about it, but because it's integral to who we are, and it's his star, because it's the star of Christ consciousness. It's the portal through which the little human ego moves, and I should say the soul moves when it abandons the ego and enters into the astral worlds. And that little word in the Bible, his star. So maybe it was a comet, they say, maybe it was this, maybe it was that, because the esoterica of it has been completely lost. It was his star because there was no he there. He was the Christ consciousness. And when Jesus tells us, "I am the way, I am the truth, I am the light," because our I is so attached to this body and this ego, we start making Jesus just bigger and bigger and more important. Whereas Jesus wasn't even a wave on the ocean. He was the ocean itself. And when he would say, "I am the way," he would mean the Christ consciousness, the complete self-offering, the drawing together by concentration and devotion of all the life force and the lifting it up inwardly, and then the giving back, returning ourselves to God, just going home and becoming one with his star and with him. This is the story of Christmas and the opportunity of Christmas. Let's not waste it. Don't squander it on more just outward activities, but take yourself back to your point of origin and return yourself to the place from which you came, which is from God.